Antiquities, Book 1. 1. The structure and order of the elements of the cosmos. 2. Concerning the lineage of Adam and the 10 generations descended from him down to the flood. 3. How the flood came about, and how Noah, saved in an ark with his kin, settled in the plain of Shinar. 4. How the tower, which his sons built in defiance of God, was raised, and how he changed their languages, and how the place where this happened was called Babylon. 5. How Noah's descendants settled the whole inhabited world. 6. That each of the nations was named after those who settled it. 7. How Abraham, our forefather, leaving the land of the Chaldeans, took possession of the land then called Canaan, now called Judea. 8. How, when famine struck Canaan, he departed for Egypt, and after spending some time there returned again. 9. The defeat of the Sodomites when the Assyrians campaigned against them. 10. How Abraham, marching out against the Assyrians, won the victory, rescued the Sodomite captives, and recovered the plunder they had taken. 11. How God destroyed the nation of the Sodomites, angered at the sins they were committing. 12. Concerning Ishmael, son of Abraham, and his Arab descendants. 13. Concerning Isaac, who was Abraham's legitimate son. 14. Concerning Sarah, Abraham's wife, and how she ended her life. 15. How, when Abraham married Keturah, the nation of the Troglodyte Arabs was born. 16. Concerning the death of Abraham. 17. Concerning the birth and upbringing of Isaac's sons, Esau and Jacob. 18. Jacob's flight to Mesopotamia out of fear of his brother, and how, after marrying there and fathering 12 sons, he returned again to Canaan. 19. How Isaac died and was buried at Hebron. This book covers a span of years which, by Josephus's reckoning, is 3008, by the Hebrews' reckoning, 1872, by Eusebius's reckoning, 3459. Those who wish to write histories, I observe, are moved by no single cause, but by many, and ones widely different from one another. Some, displaying their skill in rhetoric and hunting the reputation it brings, throw themselves into this branch of learning. Others, doing a favor to the people whose record it happens to be, have taken up the labor of writing about them beyond their own capacity. And there are those compelled by the sheer necessity of events they happen to witness to set them down in a clear account. Many more, since matters of great usefulness lay buried in ignorance, have been driven to bring their history into the open for the common good. Of the causes I have named, the last two apply to me as well. The war we Jews fought against the Romans, its course, and the outcome to which it came, having learned all this by experience, I was compelled to narrate in detail, on account of those who corrupt the truth in writing about it. But this present undertaking I have taken in hand, believing it will appear to all the Greeks worthy of study, for it is going to contain our entire ancient history and the constitution of our government, translated from the Hebrew writings. Indeed, I had already resolved earlier, when I was composing the account of the war, to explain who the Jews were from the beginning, what fortunes befell them, under what lawgiver they were trained in piety and in virtue generally, and how many wars, fought over long ages, brought them at last, against their will, into conflict with the Romans. But since the scope of that subject was too great, I separated it out and gave the history its own beginning and its own end apart from that work. As time went on, however, as tends to happen to those who set their minds on great undertakings, hesitation and delay came over me at the thought of carrying so vast a subject into a language foreign and unfamiliar to us. But there were some who, out of eagerness for the history, urged me on toward it, and above all Epaphroditus, a man devoted to every form of learning, but especially delighted by acquaintance with great affairs, since he himself had been involved in weighty matters and varied fortunes, and had shown in all of them a remarkable natural strength and an unshakable resolve toward virtue. Persuaded by him, since he always shares the delight of those able to accomplish something useful or noble, and ashamed for myself, lest I should seem to prefer idleness to the labor of achieving the finest things, I was roused to greater eagerness, weighing besides, and not lightly, whether our own ancestors had been willing to share such things, and whether any of the Greeks had shown eagerness to learn about our affairs. I found then that the second of the Ptolemies, a king especially devoted to learning and to the collecting of books, was particularly eager to have our law and the constitution founded on it translated into the Greek language, and that Eleazar, second to none in virtue among our high priests, did not begrudge that king this benefit, though he would certainly have refused, had it not been our ancestral custom to keep nothing good hidden. I thought it fitting, then, for myself to imitate the high priest's generosity of spirit, and to suppose that even now there are many, like that king, equally eager to learn. For that king did not even manage to obtain the whole of our record, but only those who were sent to Alexandria for the translation handed over the contents of the law alone. Countless things besides are set forth in the sacred writings, since a history of 5,000 years is contained within them, comprising every sort of unexpected turn of fortune, many vicissitudes of war, acts of valor by generals, and changes of government. In sum, anyone willing to work through this history from the outset will learn above all this from it, that for those who follow the will of God and do not dare to transgress laws that have been rightly established, all things turn out beyond belief successfully, and happiness is set before them by God as a prize. But to the degree that they depart from exact attention to these things, what was passable becomes impassable, and whatever they eagerly pursue as good turns instead into irreparable disaster. Now then, I urge those who take up these books to fix their minds on God, and to judge whether our lawgiver has understood his nature in a manner worthy of him, and has always assigned to him actions fitting to his power, keeping his account of him free of all the unseemly mythology found among others. Even though, given the great length of time and the antiquity involved, he had every license for false invention. For he lived 2,000 years ago, a span of time so vast that not even the poets ventured to trace back to it the births of their own gods, let alone the deeds or laws of men. As the account proceeds, it will indicate, in its proper order, the precise details found in the records. For that is what I promise to do throughout this work, to add nothing and to leave nothing out. Since almost everything among us depends on the wisdom of the lawgiver Moses, I must first say a few words about him, so that none of my readers may wonder why an account concerned with laws and deeds has here made itself party to so much natural philosophy. One must understand, then, that he considered it most necessary of all things, for anyone who intended both to order his own life well and to legislate for others, first to contemplate the nature of God, and having become through his mind a spectator of God's works, thereby to imitate, so far as possible, that best of all models, and to strive to follow it. For a lawgiver could never attain a right mind if deprived of this contemplation, nor would anything written for the sake of virtue benefit its readers, unless they were taught before all else that God, being Father and Master of all things and overseeing everything, grants a happy life to those who follow him, but surrounds with great disasters those who step outside virtue. Wishing to instill this teaching, Moses did not begin the establishment of laws for his citizens, as others do, from contracts and mutual rights and obligations, but led their minds up to God and the framing of the cosmos, and persuaded them that we men are the finest of God's works upon earth. And once he had them obedient in matters of piety, he could then easily persuade them of everything else. For other lawgivers, following myths, transferred in their accounts the shame of human failings onto the gods, and thereby gave the wicked ample excuse. But our lawgiver, having shown that God possesses virtue pure and unmixed, held that men ought to strive to share in it, and punished without mercy those who did not think or believe accordingly. I urge my readers, then, to undertake their examination with this premise in view. For to those who consider it in this light, nothing will appear unreasonable, nothing out of keeping with the majesty of God and his love for mankind. For everything holds a disposition in harmony with the nature of the universe as a whole, the lawgiver at times hinting things skillfully, at other times speaking allegorically with due solemnity, and, wherever it was better to speak directly, declaring these things in plain words. For those, however, who also wish to examine the reasons behind each provision, the inquiry would prove extensive and highly philosophical, one which I now set aside, but which, God granting me time, I shall try to write after completing this work. I shall now turn to the narrative of events, first recalling what Moses said concerning the framing of the cosmos, which I found recorded thus in the sacred books. It runs as follows, In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. But the earth did not come into view. Rather, it lay hidden in deep darkness, while a wind swept over it from above, and God commanded that light come to be. When this had happened, he considered the whole mass of matter, and separated the light from the darkness, giving the one the name night and calling the other day, and naming the beginning of light and its cessation evening and dawn. This then would be the first day, though Moses called it one. The reason for this I am able to give even now, but since I have promised to set out the explanation of all such matters in a separate work, I put off the account of it until then. After this, on the second of the days, he set the heaven over the whole, having distinguished it from the rest and judged it worthy to be arranged by itself, fixing around it a crystalline vault and, fittingly for the earth, making it southerly and rain-bearing for the benefit that comes from dew. On the third day he set the earth firm, pouring the sea around it, and on that same day plants and seeds sprang up at once from the ground. On the fourth he arrayed the heaven with sun and moon and the other stars, prescribing for them motions and courses by which the revolutions of the seasons would be marked. On the fifth day he sent forth living creatures, some swimming in the depths, others moving through the air, binding them together in fellowship and the union of mating, for the sake of increasing and multiplying their kind. On the sixth day he fashioned the race of four-footed animals, making them male and female, and on this day too he formed man. Moses says that the world and everything in it came to be within 6 days in all, and that on the seventh he rested and took a respite from his works, which is why we too observe leisure from our labors on this day, calling it Sabbath, a word that means rest in the Hebrew tongue. And indeed, Moses began to speak of natural things after the seventh day, describing the formation of man as follows. God fashioned man, taking dust from the earth, and put into him breath and soul. This man was called Adam, which in the Hebrew language means red, since he had come to be from red earth kneaded together, for such is virgin, true earth. God brought before Adam the animals arranged by kind, showing him male and female, and gave them the names by which they are still called today. Seeing that Adam had no fellowship or companionship with a female, for there was none, and finding it strange, unlike the other animals which had such companionship, God took one of his ribs while he slept and from it fashioned a woman. And Adam, when she was brought to him, recognized her as having come from himself. In the Hebrew language, a woman is called Essa, and the name of that particular woman was Eve, which means mother of all. He says that God also planted a garden toward the east, luxuriant with every kind of plant, and among these were the tree of life and another, the tree of understanding, by which one could discern what was good and what was evil. Into this garden he brought Adam and the woman and bade them tend the plants. The garden is watered by a single river that flows around the whole land in a circle and splits into four branches. The Fison, the name means multitude, flows toward India and empties into the sea, and is called by the Greeks the Ganges. The Euphrates and the Tigris go down to the Red Sea. The Euphrates is called Phoras, meaning either dispersal or flower. The Tigris is called Diglath, from which comes the sense of something narrow and swift. And the Jinn, flowing through Egypt, denotes the river that rises for us from the opposite direction, which the Greeks call the Nile. God, then, commanded Adam and the woman to eat of the other plants, but to abstain from the tree of understanding, warning them in advance that ruin would come upon them if they touched it. Now at that time, all the animals still spoke a common language, and the serpent, living alongside Adam and the woman, was envious of the happiness he supposed they would enjoy if they remained persuaded by God's commands. And thinking they would fall into misfortune if they disobeyed, he maliciously persuaded the woman to taste of the tree of understanding, telling her that they would gain the knowledge of good and evil, and that once they had it they would live a blessed life, lacking nothing of the divine. In this way he tricked the woman into scorning God's command. She tasted the plant, and enjoying its fruit, persuaded Adam to eat of it as well. At once they understood that they were naked, and, feeling shame at being exposed, they set about devising covering for themselves, for the plant had the property of sharpening perception and understanding. So they covered themselves with fig leaves, and using these to screen their nakedness, they thought themselves better off than before, now that they had found what they had previously lacked. When God came into the garden, Adam, who before had been in the habit of coming to converse with him, now withdrew, conscious of his wrongdoing. God was struck by this and asked the reason why Adam, who had formerly delighted in conversation with him, now fled and avoided it. When Adam said nothing, aware in himself that he had transgressed God's command, God said, "I had determined for you a happy life, free from every evil, your soul troubled by no care, with everything conducive to enjoyment and pleasure arising of its own accord by my providence, without labor or hardship on your part. And with these blessings present, old age would not have come upon you so quickly, and your life would have been long. But now you have insulted this plan of mine by disobeying my commands, for it is not out of virtue that you keep silent, but out of a guilty conscience." Adam tried to excuse himself of the sin and begged God not to be angry with him, laying the blame for what had happened on the woman and saying that he had sinned because she had deceived him. She in turn accused the serpent. God held Adam guilty of yielding to a woman's persuasion and condemned him to hard labor. The earth would no longer yield anything to them of its own accord, but would provide some things only for those who toiled and wore themselves out with work, and would deny them others. Eve he punished with childbirth and the pains of labor, because by the same deception with which the serpent had beguiled her, she had led Adam astray and wrapped him in misfortune. He also took away the serpent's voice, angered at its malice toward Adam, and put venom under its tongue, making it an enemy to mankind, and ordained that men should strike at its head, since there the harm it does to men resides and death would come most easily to those who defend themselves there. And he deprived it of legs, making it crawl along the ground, writhing. Having ordained that they should suffer these things, God moved Adam and Eve from the garden to another place. Two male children were born to them. The first was named Cain, a name that, translated, means acquisition, and the second Abel, which means nothing. Daughters were also born to them. The brothers took pleasure in different pursuits. Abel the younger was concerned with justice, and believing that God was present at everything he did, gave thought to virtue. His life was that of a shepherd. Cain, on the other hand, was thoroughly wicked, and looking only to gain, was the first to think of plowing the earth. He killed his brother for the following reason. When it seemed good to them to sacrifice to God, Cain offered the fruits of his farming and of the trees, while Abel brought milk and the firstborn of his flocks. God took greater pleasure in this offering, being honored by things that grow of their own accord and by nature, rather than by things produced by force through the contrivance of a grasping man. At this Cain, provoked that Abel had been preferred by God, killed his brother, and having made the body disappear, supposed he would escape notice. But God, aware of the deed, came to Cain and asked about his brother, where he might be. For many days he had not seen him, though at every other time he had seen the two of them together. Cain, at a loss and having nothing to say to God, at first claimed that he too was perplexed at not seeing his brother. But when God pressed him insistently and probed further, he grew angry and said he was not his brother's tutor and guardian, nor of what he did. At this, God directly convicted Cain of being his brother's murderer, saying, "I am amazed that you cannot say what has become of a man whom you yourself have destroyed." He released him, however, from the penalty due for the murder once he had performed a sacrifice, and through it, begged not to incur a heavier wrath. But he pronounced him accursed, and threatened to punish his descendants down to the seventh generation, and cast him out of that land together with his wife. Fearing that in his wandering he would fall prey to wild beasts and perish in that way, God bade him harbor no such gloomy suspicion, but travel the whole earth without fear of coming to any harm from beasts on that account. And, setting a mark on him by which he would be recognized, he ordered him to depart. After traversing much country, Cain settled with his wife in a place called Nod, and there made his home. Their children were also born to him. He took his punishment not as a warning, but as an occasion for the growth of wickedness, procuring every pleasure for his body, even if this meant getting it by outrage against his companions, and, increasing his household with a mass of wealth won by plunder and violence, he urged those he met on to pleasure and robbery, becoming their teacher in wicked pursuits. The freedom from care in which men had formerly lived together he did away with by the invention of measures and weights, changing what had been, through their ignorance of such things, an innocent and generous way of life into one of cunning. He was the first to set boundaries to land, and he built a city and fortified it with walls, compelling his household to gather together in one place. This city he named Anacha, after Anak, his eldest son. Anak's son was Jard, and from him came Merwel, whose son was Mathusalah, and his son Lamech, who had 77 children by his two wives, Sela and Ada. Of these, Jobal, born of Ada, pitched tents and took up the raising of flocks. Jubal, his brother by the same mother, pursued music and invented psalteries and lyres. And Jubal, one of those born of the other wife, surpassed all in bodily strength and distinguished himself in the arts of war, procuring by these things what conduces to bodily pleasure, and was also the first to devise the working of bronze. When Lamech became father of a daughter, Noma by name, since he understood the divine things clearly and foresaw that he would undergo a punishment greater than that for Cain's fratricide, he made this plain to his wives. While Adam still lived, it happened that Cain's descendants became utterly wicked, one generation after another growing worse in succession and imitation. For they gave themselves without restraint to warfare and set out on plunder, and if any among them was reluctant to kill, he showed a different kind of recklessness, committing outrage and greed. Adam, the first man made from the earth, for the narrative requires that his own account be given. After Abel had been slain, and Cain had fled because of that murder, gave thought to having children, and a powerful desire for offspring took hold of him when he had already completed 230 years of life. He lived 700 years beyond that, and then died. He had then other children as well as Seth. But to speak of the others at length would take long, and I shall try to recount only the line descended from Seth. For Seth, having been raised and having come to an age already capable of judging what is good, and himself becoming a man of the highest excellence, left behind descendants who imitated the same virtues. All of them, being good by nature, inhabited the same land without discord and prospered, with nothing troublesome befalling them even to the end, and they devised the wisdom concerning the heavenly bodies and their arrangement. And so that their discoveries should not be lost to mankind, nor perish before they came to be known, since Adam had foretold that the universe would be destroyed, once by the force of fire and again by the violence and abundance of water. They made two pillars, one of brick and the other of stone, and inscribed their discoveries on both, so that if the brick one should be destroyed by the flooding rain, the stone one would remain and make known to men what was written on it. Showing also that a brick one had been set up by them. It remains to this day in the land of Syriad. For seven generations, these men continued to hold God to be Lord of all and look to virtue in everything. But as time went on, they turned to the worse, abandoning their ancestral customs, no longer rendering to God the honors that were due, and taking no account of justice toward men. Instead, they displayed, in their conduct, twice the zeal for wickedness that they had once shown for virtue. In this way, they made God their enemy. For many angels of God now consorted with women and begot insolent sons who scorned every good thing, through their confidence in their own strength. The deeds these men are said to have dared are like those the Greeks attribute to the giants. Noah, displeased at what they were doing and finding their designs distasteful, tried to persuade them to change their thinking and their conduct for the better. But seeing that they would not yield and were firmly mastered by their pleasure in wickedness, he grew afraid that they would kill him along with his wife and children and the women who lived with them, and so left that land. God, for his part, loved Noah for his righteousness, but condemned not only the wickedness of those men, but resolved to destroy the whole of mankind then existing and to make another race free of wickedness. And, cutting short their lives, he made it so that men would no longer live as long as before, but 120 years, and turned the mainland into sea. In this way, all the rest were destroyed, but Noah alone was saved, God having devised for him a means and a way to safety of the following kind. He built an ark of four stories, 300 cubits in length, 50 in breadth, and 30 in depth, and went up into it with his wife, his sons and their wives, having placed in it whatever else would be needed to sustain them, and bringing in creatures of every kind, male and female, for the preservation of their species, and others still, seven times that number. The ark had walls and a roof strong enough that it could not be flooded from any side nor overcome by the force of the water. In this way Noah, together with his household, was saved. He himself was tenth in descent from Adam, He was the son of Lamech, whose father was Mathusalah, who was son of Enoch, son of Jared. Jared was born of Malil, and Malil from Cana, son of Enosos, who had several sisters. Enosos was the son of Seth, son of Adam. This calamity occurred in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, called Dias by the Macedonians and Marsuan by the Hebrews, for so they had arranged the year in Egypt. Moses, however, made Nisan, which is Xanthicus, the first month for the festivals, since it was in this month that he led the Hebrews out of Egypt. This month also came first for him in everything relating to the honors paid to God, though for buying and selling and other business he kept to the original order of months. He says the downpour began on the 27th of the aforementioned month. This time was 2,262 years from Adam, the first man to exist. This chronology is recorded in the sacred books, since men of that age noted with great precision both the births and the deaths of illustrious men. When Adam had already reached his 230th year, his son Seth was born, who lived 930 years. Seth, in his 205th year, begot Enosos, who, after living 905 years, handed over the care of affairs to his son Cana, having begotten him around his 190th year. Enosos lived 912 years in all. Cana, having lived 910 years, had a son Malil, born in his 170th year. Malil, after living 895 years, died, leaving behind his son Jared, whom he had begotten at the age of 165. Jared, having lived 969 years, was succeeded by his son Enoch, who was born when his father was 162. Enoch lived 365 years and then departed to the divine, so that they have not even recorded his death. Mathusalah, Enoch's son, born to him in his 165th year, had a son Lamech at about the age of 187, having himself held the leadership for 969 years. Lamech, having ruled 777 years, appointed his son Noah head of affairs. Noah, born to Lamech when he had reached his 188th year, took up the leadership of affairs at the age of 950. These years, added together, fill out the total given above. Let no one examine the deaths of these men, for they extended their lives well into those of their children and grandchildren. Let him look only to their births. When God had given the sign and the rain had begun, the water came down for 40 whole days, so that it rose 15 cubits above the earth. This was the reason why more people could not be saved. They had no means of escape. When the rain stopped, the water only slowly began to subside, over 150 days, so that by the seventh month, on its seventh day, it was gradually receding and abating. Then, the ark having come to rest on a certain peak of a mountain in Armenia, Noah, realizing this, opened the ark, saw a small patch of dry ground around it, and now in better hope, waited quietly. A few days later, when the water had receded further, he sent out a raven, wanting to learn whether any other part of the earth left bare by the water was now safe for landing. It found the whole surface still under water and returned to Noah. 7 days later, he sent out a dove to learn how things stood with the land. It came back covered in mud and carrying an olive branch, and from this he learned that the earth was free of the flood. He waited 7 more days, then released the animals from the ark and came out himself with his family, and after sacrificing to God, he feasted with his household. The Armenians call this place the landing place, for it was there that the ark came safely to rest, and they still show the remains of it to this day. This flood and the ark are mentioned by all who have written the histories of foreign peoples, among them Berossus the Chaldean. In his account of the flood, he writes something like this. It is said that a part of the ship still survives in Armenia, on the mountain of the Chordaeans, and that some people scrape off pieces of the bitumen and carry them away, using what they bring back as charms. Hieronymus the Egyptian, who wrote the history of Phoenicia, mentions these things too, as does Amnesias and several others. And Nicolaus of Damascus, in the 96th book of his history, writes of them as follows. Above the land of the Minyans in Armenia, there is a great mountain called Baris, where it is said that many people fled for refuge at the time of the flood and were saved, and that one man, carried on an ark, ran aground on the summit, and the remains of the timbers were preserved for a long time. This could well be the same man that Moses, the lawgiver of the Jews, wrote about. Noah, fearing that God might flood the earth every year, having decreed the destruction of mankind, burned sacrifices and begged God that from then on things should remain in their original order, and that he would never again bring such a disaster, one that would risk destroying the whole race of living things. Instead, having punished the wicked, God should spare those who had been left alive through their goodness and had been judged worthy to escape the calamity, for they would be worse off than the dead, condemned to a harsher fate if they were not saved completely, but were kept back only to face a second flood. Having learned the fear and the story of the first one, and now facing the destruction of the second. So Noah pleaded that God would receive his sacrifice with favor and never again cast such wrath upon the earth, so that men, devoting themselves to its labors and founding cities, might live happily and lack none of the good things they had enjoyed before the flood, down to a distant old age and a length of life like that of those who had lived before them. When Noah had made these entreaties, God, who loved the man for his righteousness, promised to bring his prayers to fulfillment. He said that he himself had not destroyed those who perished, but that they had suffered this punishment through their own wickedness. Nor, if he had resolved to wipe out the human race once it existed, would he have brought men into life in the first place. It would have been wiser never to have granted them life at all than to give it, and then destroy it. But those who insulted my reverence and virtue forced me to inflict this punishment on them. I will cease from now on to exact vengeance for wrongdoing with such great wrath, and all the more so since you ask it of me. And if I should ever again send a long storm, do not be afraid of the size of the rains, for the water will never again flood the earth. I do, however, urge you to abstain from human bloodshed and to keep yourselves free of murder, punishing anyone who does such a thing, while making use of all the other animals as you wish and as your appetites desire, for I have made you masters of them all, of those on land and in water and of whatever moves through the air above, except for their blood, for in that is the life. I will give you a sign that the rains will cease by showing you the rainbow in the sky, for among the people there it is held that the bow belongs to God. Having said this and made this promise, God departed. Noah lived 350 years after the flood, and having passed all that time in happiness, he died at the age of 950 years. Let no one, comparing the life we live now and the brevity of our years to the years of the ancients, judge what is said of them to be false, reasoning that because no one today lives so long a span, those men did not reach such a length of life either. For those men were beloved of God and had themselves been made by God, and because their food was better suited to a longer life, it is reasonable that they lived so great a number of years. Besides, God granted them a longer life because of their virtue and their useful discoveries in astronomy and geometry, which they could not have safely foretold had they not lived 600 years. For it is after that many years that the great year is completed. All who have written the ancient histories, both Greek and foreign, bear witness to what I say. Manetho, who compiled the record of the Egyptians, and Berossus, who gathered the history of the Chaldeans and Machus and Hesychius, and besides these Hieronymus the Egyptian, who wrote the history of Phoenicia, all agree with what I have said, and so do Hesiod, Hecateus, Hellanicus, Acusilaus, and besides these Ephorus and Nicolaus, who record that the ancients lived 1,000 years. On these matters, let each reader judge as he thinks best. Noah's three sons, Shem, Japheth, and Ham, had been born 100 years before the flood, and they were the first to come down from the mountains into the plains and settle there, and they persuaded the rest of the people, who were still very much afraid of the plains because of the flood and reluctant to come down from the high places, to take courage and follow their example. The plain in which they first settled them is called Shinar. But when God commanded them, because of their great numbers, to send out colonies, so that they would not quarrel with one another, but, farming a great deal of land, might enjoy an abundance of its fruits, they disobeyed God out of foolishness. And so they fell into misfortune and came to recognize their sin. For when they had grown numerous in youthful strength, God again urged them to found colonies. But they, not attributing their prosperity to his favor, but supposing their own strength to be the cause of their abundance, would not obey. To their disobedience of God's will, they added the suspicion that they were being urged toward colonization as a plot, so that once divided they would be easier to attack. And it was Nimrod who incited them to this insolence and contempt of God. He was a grandson of Ham, Noah's son, a bold man and mighty in strength. He persuaded them not to attribute their prosperity to God, but to consider that their own courage was what provided it. And little by little, he turned the state of affairs into a tyranny, believing that the only way to make men stop fearing God was for them to keep on relying upon his own power. And he threatened that he would take vengeance on God if he should ever wish to flood the earth again. For he would build a tower higher than the water could reach, and he would avenge the destruction of his ancestors. The people were eager to follow Nimrod's decrees, considering it slavery to submit to God, and they built the tower, sparing no effort and showing no reluctance for the work. And because of the great number of hands, it rose in height faster than anyone would have expected. Its thickness, however, was so great that its height appeared smaller to onlookers than it really was. It was built of baked brick bound together with bitumen, so that it would not be worn away by water. Seeing them driven to such madness, God decided not to destroy them utterly, since they had not been made wiser even by the destruction of the earlier generation, but he threw them into confusion by making them speak different languages, and by this multiplicity of tongues, he made them unable to understand one another. The place where they built the tower is now called Babylon, because of the confusion that first arose there regarding their language, for the Hebrews call confusion Babel. The Sibyl also mentions this tower and the differing languages of mankind, speaking as follows. When all men spoke the same language, some of them built an exceedingly high tower, as though they meant to climb up to heaven by it. But the gods sent winds and overturned the tower, and gave each man his own language, and this is why the city came to be called Babylon. Hesychius also mentions the plain called Shinar in the land of Babylonia, speaking as follows. Those of the priests who survived took the sacred vessels of Zeus and Aeolus and came to Shinar in Babylonia. From that point on they scattered, and because of the difference in their languages they founded colonies everywhere, and each group took possession of whatever land they came upon and to which God led them, until every continent was filled with them, both inland and along the coast, and some even crossed over by ship and settled the islands. Some of the nations still preserve the names given by their founders, others have changed them, and still others have altered their names to a form thought clearer to the peoples living around them. The Greeks are responsible for this. Once they grew powerful in later times, they claimed the old glory of these nations as their own, embellishing the peoples with names pleasing and orderly to their own ears, as though the nations had originated from themselves. Now these were the sons of Noah's sons, to whom, in their honor, the peoples they seized possession of a land gave their names. Japheth, Noah's son, had 7 sons. They settled the region beginning from the Taurus and Amanus mountains, and advanced through Asia as far as the river Tanais, and through Europe as far as Cadiz, taking possession of whatever land they came upon. And since no one had settled there before them, they gave the nations their own names. Those now called Galatians by the Greeks, but formerly called Gomerites, were founded by Gomer. Magog founded those named after him the Magogites, called Scythians by the Greeks. Of Japheth's sons, from Javan and Madai, from Madai come the Madians, called Medes by the Greeks, and from Javan come Ionia and all the Greeks. Thobal also founded the Thoblites, who are now called Iberians. And the Messenians, founded by Meshes, are now called Cappadocians, though a trace of their old name is still shown. There is a city among them, even now, called Mazaka, which makes clear to those able to understand that this was once the name of the whole nation. Theras named those he ruled Therians, though the Greeks renamed them Thracians. So many are the nations settled by the sons of Japheth. Gomer had 3 sons. Ashenax founded the Ashenaxians, now called Reginians by the Greeks. Riphath founded the Riphathians, called Paphlagonians, and Thigramas founded the Thigrameans, whom the Greeks named Phrygians. Javan, son of Japheth, likewise had 3 sons. Elissa founded the Elissians, whom he ruled, now called the Aeolians. Tharsis founded the Tharsians, for this was the old name of Cilicia, as shown by the fact that Tarsus, the most notable of their cities and their capital, is so called with a tau in place of a theta. Chethim took possession of the island of Chethima, now called Cyprus, and from it all the islands and most of the coastal regions are called Chethem by the Hebrews. A witness to what I say is one of the cities of Cyprus, which has managed to keep this name. It is called Kishon by those who have Hellenized it, but even so it has not entirely escaped the name of Chethem. Such, then, were the nations that sprang from the sons and grandsons of Japheth. There is a point that the Greeks may perhaps not know, and having stated it, I will return to relating the rest of what I set out to tell. The names have been Hellenized for the pleasure of my readers, to suit the elegance of my composition, for this is not the native form of these names among us. Rather, they all share one form and one ending. Noah, for instance, is called No among us, and this form is kept throughout, whatever the shape of the name. The sons of Ham took possession of the land from Syria and the Amanus and Lebanon mountains, seizing whatever parts of it faced the sea, and extending their holdings as far as the ocean. Some of their names have vanished entirely, others have changed and been reshaped into other forms and are now hard to recognize, and only a few have kept their names unaltered. Ham had four sons. Time did no harm to the name of Chus, for the Ethiopians he ruled are still called Chusites, both by themselves and by all the peoples of Asia, even now. The memory of the name was also preserved among the Mercians, for we all who live there call Egypt Mersa and the Egyptians Mercians. Phut too founded Libya, naming its inhabitants Fudites after himself. There is also a river in the land of the Moors bearing this name, and this is why most of the Greek historians can be found mentioning both this river and the region beside it, called Fut. But the name that now belongs to it has changed, taken from the sons of Mesraim, called Libyes. I will explain shortly the reason it also came to be called Africa. Canaan, the fourth son of Ham, settled the land now called Judea and named it Canaan after himself. From these came further sons. Chus had six sons, of whom Sabas founded the Sabaeans, Evilas founded the Evilians, now called the Gichelians, Sabaeus founded the Sabaethinians, called Astaborians by the Greeks. Sabactas also founded the Sabactinians. Ramos settled the Ramians and had two sons, Judadas, who settled the Judadeans, an Ethiopian people in the west, and left them named after himself, and Sabaeus, who settled the Sabaeans. Nimrod, son of Chus, remained among the Babylonians and made himself their tyrant, as I have already shown. Of the eight sons of Mesraim, all together took possession of the land from Gaza to Egypt, though only the name of Philistinus survived for the country. The Greeks call his portion Palestine. Of the others, Laumius, Anamia, and Labim, who alone settled in Libya and likewise named the country after himself, and Nedim, Pethrasim, Cheslim, and Chephthim, we know nothing beyond their names, for the Ethiopian war, which I will describe later, uprooted their cities. Canaan too had sons. Sidonius, who founded a city named after himself in Phoenicia, called Sidon by the Greeks. Amathus, who settled Amathus, still called Amathe by the natives today, though the Macedonians renamed it Epiphania after one of their successors. Arudius, who held the island of Aradus, and Arochius, who held Ars in Lebanon. Of the remaining seven, the Hivite, the Hittite, the Jebusite, the Amorite, the Girgashite, the Sinite, and the Samarite, we have nothing but their names from the sacred books, for the Hebrews destroyed their cities, and this came about through a disaster of the following kind. After the flood, once the earth had returned to its natural state, Noah turned to farming, and having planted it with vines, when in due season the fruit had ripened, and he had gathered the harvest, and the wine was ready for use, he offered sacrifice and was making merry. Overcome by drink, he fell into sleep and lay uncovered, in an unseemly posture. His youngest son saw him and, laughing, pointed him out to his brothers, but they covered their father. When Noah learned of it, he prayed for prosperity on his other sons, but on Ham, because of their kinship, he did not himself pronounce a curse. Instead, he cursed Ham's descendants. So while the others escaped the curse, God pursued Canaan's sons for it. Of this we will speak further in what follows. To Shem, the third of Noah's sons, five sons were born, who settled Asia as far as the Indian Ocean, beginning from the Euphrates. Elam left behind the Elamites, the ancestors of the Persians. Assuerus founded the city of Nineveh and named his subjects Assyrians, who prospered above all others. Arphaxad named those now called Chaldeans after himself, the Arphaxadians, having ruled over them. Aram held the Aramaeans, whom the Greeks call Syrians. Those now called Lydians, then called Ludians, were founded by Ludas. Of Aram's four sons, Uz founded Trachonitis and Damascus, which lies between Palestine and Celesyria, Ul founded Armenia, Gether founded the Bactrians, and Mash founded the Mashanians, called Spasinu-Cherax in modern times. To Arphaxad was born a son, Shelah, and to him Eber, from whom the Jews were originally called Hebrews. Eber had two sons, Joktan and Peleg. Peleg was so named because he was born at the time of the division of dwelling places, for the Hebrews call division Phalek. Joktan's sons, the sons of Eber, were Elmadad, Saleph, Azermoth, Iri, Edoram, Uzal, Dakla, Ebel, Abimael, Saphaz, Ophir, Uilaz, and Jobab. These inhabit the region from the Kafan River in India to the neighboring Syria. So much then for the sons of Shem. Now I will turn to the Hebrews. To Peleg, son of Eber, was born a son, Reu, to him, Serug, to whom Nahor was born as a son. To him, Terah, who became the father of Abram, the 10th generation from Noah, born in the 292nd year after the flood. Terah fathered Abram in his 70th year. Nahor fathered Terah when he himself was already 120 years old. Serug was born to Nahor around the 132nd year. Reu fathered Serug at 130 years of age. In the same years, Peleg also had Reu. Eber, at 134 years, fathered Peleg, having himself been fathered by Salah when Salah was 130, and Salah had been begotten by Arphaxad in his 135th year. Arphaxad was Shem's son, born 12 years after the flood. Abram had brothers, Nahor and Haran. Of these, Haran, leaving behind a son, Lot and daughters, Sarah and Milcah, died among the Chaldeans in a city called Ur of the Chaldeans, and his tomb is shown there to this day. His nieces were married by his brothers. Nahor married Milcah, Abram married Sarah. Because Terah had come to hate Chaldea on account of his grief for Haran, the whole family moved to Haran in Mesopotamia, where Terah also died and was buried, having lived 205 years. For by now the span of human life was already being cut short, growing briefer and briefer down to the birth of Moses, after whom the limit of life was set at 120 years, God having fixed it at exactly the span that Moses himself came to live. Now Nahor had eight sons by Milcah: Uz, Buz, Kemuel, Hesed, Hazo, Pildash, Jidlaf, and Bethuel. These were Nahor's legitimate sons, for Teba, Gaham, Tahash, and Maka were born to him by his concubine Ruma. To Bethuel, one of Nahor's legitimate sons, were born a daughter Rebekah and a son, Laban. Abram took Lot, the son of his brother Haran and the brother of his own wife Sarah, as an adopted son, having no legitimate child of his own, and left Chaldea at the age of 75, at God's command, to move into Canaan. There he settled and left it to his descendants, a man skilled in understanding all things and persuasive to those who heard him, unerring in whatever he conjectured. For this reason, having begun to think more highly of virtue than others did, he resolved to reform and change the prevailing opinion about God that everyone then held. He was thus the first to dare to declare that God is the one creator of all things, and that whatever else contributes to human welfare does so by his command, each thing supplying its share, not by its own inherent power. He inferred this from the changes that befall the land and sea, and from all that happens to the sun, the moon, and everything in the heavens. For if these bodies had power of their own, they would surely provide for their own good order. But since they plainly lack this, it is clear that whatever service they render us for our benefit, they render not by their own authority, but by the power of the one who commands them, to whom alone it is right to render honor and thanksgiving. For these views, the Chaldeans and the other people of Mesopotamia rose up against him, and he resolved to emigrate. By the will and with the help of God, he took possession of the land of Canaan. There he settled, built an altar, and offered sacrifice to God. Our father Abram is mentioned by Berossus, though not by name, in these words: after the flood in the 10th generation, there lived among the Chaldeans a certain righteous man, great and skilled in the things of heaven. Hecateus has done more than merely mention him, for he composed and left behind a book about him. Nicolaus of Damascus, in the fourth book of his histories, writes as follows: Abram's reigned as king, an immigrant who arrived with an army from the land above Babylon called the land of the Chaldeans. Not long afterward, he moved on from that country as well, together with his people, into the land then called Canaan, but now Judea, and his descendants there multiplied greatly, of whom I shall give a full account in another work. Even now the name of Abram is honored in the region of Damascus, and a village is pointed out, named after him, called the Dwelling of Abram. When famine later struck Judea, Abram, learning that the Egyptians were prospering, was eager to move among them, both to share in their abundance and to hear what their priests said about the gods, intending either to follow them, if they were found to hold better views, or, being himself of sounder judgment, to bring them over to something better. Taking Sarah with him, and fearing the Egyptians' notorious passion for other men's wives, lest the king should kill him because of his wife's beauty, he devised the following scheme. He pretended to be her brother, and taught her to play along, since it would be to their advantage. When they arrived in Egypt, things turned out for Abram just as he had suspected. The beauty of his wife was quickly reported abroad, so that Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, not content with what was said of her, but eager to see for himself, was on the point of laying hands on Sarah. But God thwarted his unjust desire with sickness and civil disorder. And when he sacrificed to learn how to be rid of it, the priests declared, in accordance with God's anger, that the affliction was upon him because of his wish to violate the wife of a stranger. Frightened, he questioned Sarah as to who she was and whom she had brought with her, and on learning the truth he begged Abram's pardon, for, thinking her only a sister and not a wife, he had been eager to form a marriage connection with her, not moved by lustful desire to violate her. He presented Abram with great wealth and admitted him into the company of the most learned Egyptians, and from this, his reputation for virtue became even more distinguished. For the Egyptians, being pleased with differing customs and disparaging one another's practices, were consequently ill-disposed toward each other. Abram, meeting with each group and refuting the arguments they made for their own views, showed them to be empty and containing nothing true. Admired by them in these discussions as a man of the greatest understanding, skilled not only in grasping, but in persuading others of whatever he undertook to teach, he shared with them the science of arithmetic and passed on to them the knowledge of astronomy. For before Abram's arrival, the Egyptians were ignorant of these things, which traveled to Egypt from the Chaldeans, and from there passed on to the Greeks. When he came into Canaan, he divided the land with Lot, since their shepherds quarreled over the pasturage. The choice, however, he left to Lot. Abram himself took the hill country left over by Lot's choice and settled in the city of Nabro, which is older than Tanis in Egypt by 7 years. Lot took the land lying toward the plain, by the river Jordan, not far from the city of the Sodomites, which was then fertile but is now destroyed by the will of God, the reason for which I will explain in its proper place. At that time, while the Assyrians held sway over Asia, the Sodomites were flourishing, both in wealth and in a large population of young men. 5 kings ruled the country: Bala, Balias, Senabar, Simabaroz, and the king of the Balanites, each governing his own portion. The Assyrians marched against them, dividing their army into 4 parts and besieged them, each division under its own commander. A battle was fought, the Assyrians won, and they imposed tribute on the kings of the Sodomites. For 12 years the Sodomites remained subject, paying the tribute imposed on them, but in the 13th year they rebelled, and an Assyrian army crossed against them under the commanders Amraphel, Arioch, Chedorlaomer, and Thadal. These plundered the whole of Syria and destroyed the descendants of the giants, and, reaching Sodom, encamped in the valley called the Pits of Bitumen. For there were pits there at that time, though now, since the city of the Sodomites has vanished, that valley has become the lake called Asphaltitis, of which I will speak again shortly. When the Sodomites engaged the Assyrians and a hard-fought battle followed, many of them were killed and the rest were taken captive, and among them Lot was led away, having come as an ally of the Sodomites. When Abram heard of their disaster, fear for his kinsman Lot came over him, together with pity for the Sodomites, who were his friends and neighbors. Resolving to help them, he did not delay, but pressed on and, falling on the Assyrians by night on the 5th day near Dan, for so the other source of the Jordan is called, and catching them before they could arm, he killed those who were in their beds, having no warning of the disaster, while those who had not yet gone to sleep, unable to fight because of drunkenness, fled. Abram pursued them and drove them, by the second day, all the way to Hobah in the territory of Damascus, showing that victory does not lie in numbers and multitude of hands, but that the eagerness and courage of the fighters prevail over any number. For he overcame so great an army with 318 of his own servants and 3 friends. As many of them as escaped fled home in disgrace. Abram, having saved the captive Sodomites, who had been taken by the Assyrians before he arrived, and his kinsman Lot, turned back in peace. The king of the Sodomites met him at a certain place called the King's Plain, where Melchizedek, king of Salem, received him. The name means righteous king, and such he was by common consent, so much so that for this reason he was also made priest of God. He later called Salem Jerusalem. This Melchizedek supplied Abram's army with hospitality and provided a great abundance of provisions, and during the feast he began to praise him and to bless God for having delivered his enemies into his hands. When Abram offered him a tenth of the spoils, he accepted the gift. The king of the Sodomites urged Abram to keep the spoils, but asked to have the people back, his own countrymen whom Abram had rescued from the Assyrians. Abram said he would not do this, nor would he take any further profit from that plunder beyond what served as food for the men who had marched with him, for his household. He did, however, give a share to the friends who had campaigned with him, of whom the first was called Eshal, and the others Ener and Mamber. God, praising Abram's virtue, said, "You will not lose the rewards you deserve for such good conduct." When Abram answered by asking what gratification such rewards could bring him, since he had no one to succeed him, for he was still childless, God announced that a son would be born to him, and a great progeny after him, so numerous that it would match the stars in number. On hearing this, Abram, as God commanded, offered a sacrifice. The manner of the sacrifice was this. He divided, at God's command, a 3-year-old heifer, a 3-year-old goat, and a 3-year-old ram alike, and a turtle dove and a pigeon, but he did not divide the birds. Then, before the altar was set up, birds of prey swooped down eager for the blood, and a divine voice was heard foretelling that his descendants would be evil neighbors' subjects for 400 years in Egypt, but that after suffering hardship there, they would overcome their enemies, and, prevailing in war over the Canaanites, would possess their land and their cities. Abram was living near the oak called Ajijah's. The place is in Canaan, not far from the city of the Hebronites. And, distressed that his wife had no child, he begged God to grant him offspring, a son. When God urged him to take courage, promising that all else would go well for him, as it had since he was led out of Mesopotamia for his good, and that children would be born to him, Sarah, at God's bidding, gave one of her maidservants, an Egyptian named Hagar, to Abram so that he might father a child by her. But once she had conceived, the maidservant dared to insult Sarah insolently, acting as if she would become mistress herself, on the assumption that authority would pass to the child she was to bear. When Abram handed her over to Sarah for punishment, Hagar, unable to bear the harsh treatment, plotted to run away and begged God to take pity on her. As she made her way through the desert, a divine angel met her and told her to return to her masters, for if she showed good sense, she would attain a better life. Even now, he said, her arrogant and stubborn treatment of her mistress had brought these troubles upon her. If she disobeyed God and pressed further on, she would perish. But if she went back, she would become the mother of a son who would rule that land. Persuaded by this, she returned to her masters and was forgiven. Not long after she bore Ishmael, a name one might render heard by God, because God had listened to her plea. Abram was already 86 years old when this son was born to him, and when he had passed his 99th year, God appeared to him and announced that he would have a son by Sarah as well. God commanded him to call the boy Isaac and declared that great nations and kings would spring from him, and that after wars they would possess the whole of Canaan from Sidon to Egypt. God further ordered, wishing that his line should remain unmixed with others, that they circumcise their private parts, and that this be done on the 8th day after birth. I will explain the reason for our circumcision elsewhere. When Abram inquired also about Ishmael, whether he would live, God indicated that he would live long and become the father of great nations. Abram, giving thanks to God for these things, was circumcised at once, along with all the members of his household and his son Ishmael, who was then 13 years old, while Abram himself was 99. At about this time, the people of Sodom, arrogant because of their numbers and the greatness of their wealth, became insolent toward men and impious toward God, so much so that they no longer remembered the benefits they had received from him. They grew hateful of strangers and shunned association with others. Angered at this, God resolved to punish them for their arrogance, to raise their city, and to devastate the land so completely that it would never again put forth so much as a plant or a fruit. When God had made this decision concerning the Sodomites, Abram, seeing three angels, was sitting by the oak of Mamre near the gate of his own courtyard. Taking them for strangers, he rose, greeted them, and when they had come in to him, urged them to accept his hospitality. When they consented, he at once ordered loaves to be made from fine flour, and slaughtering and roasting a calf, brought it to them as they reclined beneath the oak. They pretended to eat, and then asked about his wife, where Sarah might be. When he told them she was inside, they said that when they returned they would find her already a mother. At this, the woman smiled and said that childbearing was impossible for her, since she was 90 years old and her husband 100. At that they no longer concealed themselves, but revealed that they were angels of God, and that one had been sent to announce the birth of the child, the other two to overthrow the Sodomites. On hearing this, Abram grieved for the Sodomites and rose and pleaded with God, begging him not to destroy the righteous and good along with the wicked. God replied that there was no good man among the Sodomites, for if there were 10 among them, he would forgive them all the punishment due for their sins, and Abram fell silent. The angels then arrived in the city of the Sodomites, and Lot invited them to be his guests, for he was exceedingly kind to strangers, having learned this from Abram's own generosity. But the Sodomites, seeing the young men remarkably handsome in appearance and lodged with Lot, turned to violence and outrage against their beauty. When Lot urged them to restrain themselves and not proceed to shame his guests, but to respect the honor of his household, and said that if their desire was so uncontrollable, he would give them his daughters instead, still they would not be persuaded. God, then, enraged at their outrages, struck them blind, so that they could not find the entrance to the house, and condemned the Sodomites to a universal destruction. Lot, having been told by God of the coming ruin of the Sodomites, took his wife and his daughters, two of whom were still unmarried, for the suitors had scorned the warning to leave, dismissing what Lot told them as foolishness, and departed. God then hurled a bolt upon the city, and with a light conflagration, burned it to the ground along with its inhabitants, obliterating the land, as I have already related earlier when writing of the Jewish war. Lot's wife, however, as they withdrew, kept turning back to look at the city and meddling with matters God had forbidden her to concern herself with, was turned into a pillar of salt. I have seen it myself, for it still remains to this day. Lot himself escaped with his daughters to a small district spared by the fire, still called Zoar to this day, for that is what the Hebrews call a small thing. There he lived out a wretched existence, deprived of human company and short of food. His daughters, supposing that all mankind had been destroyed, took care to lie with their father unnoticed. They did this so that their family line should not die out. Sons were born, to the elder Moab, whose name one might render from his father. The younger bore Ammon, whose name signifies son of the people. From them are founded the Moabites, still today a very great nation, and the Ammonites founded by the other. Both peoples belong to Seal Syria. Such, then, was the outcome of Lot's departure from the Sodomites. Abram, meanwhile, moved to Gerar in Palestine, bringing Sarah along in the guise of his sister, playing the same part as before out of fear, for he was afraid of Abimelech, the king of that region, who himself, falling in love with Sarah, was prepared to violate her. He was kept from his desire by a severe illness God sent upon him, and when the physicians had given him up for lost, he fell asleep and saw in a dream that he must do the stranger's wife no wrong. Recovering somewhat, he told his friends that God had inflicted this illness upon him in order to avenge the stranger by keeping his wife unmolested. For she was not, in fact, his sister, but his wife bound to him by law, and he promised that he would treat him kindly from then on, now that his fears for his wife had been removed. Having said this, he sent for Abram on his friend's advice, and told him he need fear nothing further concerning his wife, as though she would suffer any dishonor, for God was watching over him. And in keeping with their bond of friendship, he would receive her back unmolested. Since God was witness, and his wife's conscience as well, Abimelech said he would never have desired her at all had he known she was a married woman, since he had taken her only supposing her to be a sister. A wrong he had not, in fact, committed. He urged Abram to bear him no ill will and to make God favorable toward him, and said that if Abram wished to remain with him, he would want for nothing, while if he chose to leave, he would be given an escort and everything he might need on his journey. To this, Abram replied that he had not lied about his wife's kinship, for she was in truth the daughter of his brother, and that without such a pretense he could not have supposed his stay safe. As for the illness, he said, he had not caused it, though he had been eager for Abimelech's recovery, and he declared himself ready to remain with him. So Abimelech shared with him both land and wealth, and they agreed to deal with one another without deceit, swearing their oath over a well, which they called Beersheba, the well of the oath, a name it still bears among the people of that region to this day. Not long afterward, a son was born to Abram by Sarah, just as God had foretold him, whom he named Isaac, meaning laughter, for Sarah had smiled when God said she would bear a child, not expecting to give birth at her advanced age. She was 90 years old, and Abram 100.